You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. I have a great guest with me here today, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, best known for his role in the famous net neutrality debate and for his social media banter. Mr. Chairman, thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, Brad, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
So with your tenure at the FCC coming to an end, maybe a good place to start would be just briefly, what do you think are the highlights or main accomplishments you'll reflect on from the last few years and be most proud of?
Well, there are a number of them, and we're going to be putting out a comprehensive list, but I think the highlights would be, number one, our work to close the digital divide. Number two, our efforts to promote American leadership in 5G. Number three, some of our consumer protection measures on things from robocalls to designating 988 as a three-digit number for suicide prevention and mental health. And number four, just more internally, transforming how the agency operates, making it more transparent, creating an Office of Economics and Analytics, and just really tapping the talent of our staff to deliver results. So I'm really proud of all we've done over the last 4 years together, and hope it will be recognized in due course.
Yeah, we should sure hope. And one of the things from your tenure that I think people will definitely remember is the fight over net neutrality. So for listeners who don't know, net neutrality was an Obama-era regulation applied to internet service providers that under your leadership, the FCC repealed in 2017. Could we start with maybe just a layman's definition of what net neutrality is?
So the claimed definition on the left of net neutrality was making sure that consumers could access whatever content they wanted on the internet. But in reality, what it was heavy-handed government control of broadband networks. That's essentially how it ended up turning out at the FCC. And to me, at least, this was addressing a problem that didn't really exist. We didn't have a broken internet in 2015. And since we made our decision to repeal these internet regulations, the world hasn't ended. The internet is in fact stronger than ever. So to me, at least, it was a solution in search of a problem.
So one thing that was interesting was when the FCC first unveiled that they were going to repeal this regulation, there was a lot of sky is falling doom and gloom rhetoric from Democratic officials, kind of liberal advocacy groups, and other media outlets. I still remember this one tweet from the Senate Democrats where they sent out every single word, if net neutrality is repealed, you will get the internet one word at a time. And then the ACLU wrote this bizarre claim where they said that the ISPs will slow down Domino's if another pizza company pays them, or all sorts of this. So first, what was it like? Did you have any idea when you went to repeal this regulation that it would start such kind of a viral firestorm? And what was it like being under the target of so many people?
I definitely knew that it would be a controversial decision in some quarters. I mean, this is obviously an area where a lot of people might disagree with each other. But what I didn't anticipate was just the overwhelming tide of misstatements, mischaracterizations, or outright lies that people would advance. I mean, the notion that you'd have to pay $14.99 per month to be able to access Twitter, the notion that this was the end of the internet as we know it, as Senator Bernie Sanders and CNN proclaimed, or as you pointed out, the entire Senate Democratic Caucus falsely saying that you'll get the internet one word at a time. And I replied to that 2 years later, February 2019, as you might have seen, the speeds had doubled since we made our decisions, contrary to what they proclaimed. And so, to me at least, I knew our decision was the right one. And I knew that in time that decision would be vindicated. And now I think we're at a position where even some of these advocates, well, probably not them, the bad faith advocates, but more reasonable people, I think, would agree that the internet is fine. This decision wasn't a bad one. And to the contrary, we've seen now millions more Americans get access to the internet. As I said, speeds for fixed broadband have more than doubled. We've seen records for fiber deployment in 2018, 2019. And during the pandemic, our internet infrastructure held up really well, contrary to Europe, where they had to go hand in hand to YouTube and Hulu and ask them to proactively throttle their content from HD to SD because they weren't sure that they would have a strong internet infrastructure. Europe having these net neutrality regulations that advocates love so much. So to me, at least, it was a lot of sound and fury that ended in pretty much nothing. And that's, it's unfortunate. And also the personal vitriol that was directed at me was disgusting. I would certainly hope that whoever comes in these positions in years to come doesn't have to face some of this nonsense. You know, whatever our disagreements on policy, I think at the very least we should agree that people shouldn't be phoning in bomb threats to disrupt our work. You shouldn't be threatening to murder the SEC chairman's kids and do all sorts of other stuff. It's just the very worst of political, it's not even political discourse. It's just the threats of violence to achieve political ends. And to me, it was awful, but you know, I took the arrows and I'm still standing.
Yeah, it really is horrible. And I'm sorry you had to go through that. But to circle back to one point that you just made, one thing that I think wasn't apparent to a lot of people is they got these apocalyptic doomsday predictions about what would happen if net neutrality went away, and which weren't true. But at least that was the argument being made. Not a lot of people understood the case for getting rid of the regulation. And as I understand it, it's that it was imposing costs that were reducing investment in the expansion of the internet. Is that right? Or what was the big kind of thing you hope to achieve by getting the government out of the way in this case?
Well, so part of it was the fact that this entire heavy-handed utility-style regulatory framework wasn't necessary to solve any particular problem. I mean, I think most people would agree that if any government agency is going to adopt a regulation, it should be tailored to address a particular problem. Well, what was the problem with the internet in 2015? It wasn't broken. Internet infrastructure was growing. The investment was increasing. The internet was free and open. People could access whatever information they wanted. That's problem number one. Problem number two, this particular solution using what's called Title II of the Communications Act is very heavy-handed regulation. It was developed in the 1930s to regulate Ma Bell, the telephone monopoly. And you know, look, I'm sorry, but you can't tell me that every single one of the 4,462 internet providers in the United States, from the big companies we all know to Amplex Internet in Lucky, Ohio, to SpaceX, which hasn't even launched broadband service yet widely, you can't tell me that all of them are anti-competitive monopolists. It's just stupid to suggest that they are. And so to me, at least, a more tailored approach, one that relies more on the FTC to police any competitive conduct, and for the FCC to impose transparency requirements so that ISPs have to disclose their business practices, that was a much better way to attack the problem than a one-size-fits-all solution from the 1930s before anyone had ever thought of the internet. So those are the two basic concerns that I had.
And we did see, after we got net neutrality off the books, an increase in investment and the internet reaching more people, right?
Absolutely. Now, because we have a more markets-based framework, companies have the regulatory certainty needed to be able to raise capital, hire work crews, and build the networks of the future. And that doesn't have to happen. I mean, I think a lot of advocates on the other side simply assume, oh, we'll just apply utility-style regulations and everyone will have the internet because it's a utility. That's kind of not the way it works in the real world. You know, people are not going to invest unless they see return on that investment. And so the more heavy-handed the regulatory burden is, the less likely it is that companies are going to build out the internet, especially the smaller companies, companies that no one's ever heard of, that are critical to providing access in rural areas, tribal areas, other low-income areas where the big providers just don't seem interested in serving.
One thing that always interested me was that progressives like to claim, or people on the left, that they fight for like the little guy or the consumer against big business, et cetera. But net neutrality was actually, if I recall correctly, endorsed by a lot of big business, by a lot of big tech, the Googles and the Facebooks of the world. And that, to me, was an immediate red flag. When you have big companies endorsing regulation on their own industry, that suggests to me kind of cronyism, or that they know it will crowd out competitors. Was that how you saw the kind of opposition from the industry forum?
I think a lot of people expressed the concern that essentially some of these Silicon Valley tech giants were pushing regulations that they wouldn't be willing to abide by themselves. And there were warnings in 2017 that, look, you're pushing these heavy-handed regulations on your competitors in the network operator space, but you just turn around and it's not inconceivable to see that the snake will come to bite you eventually. And that's exactly what's happening now. You see calls, bipartisan calls here in Congress to regulate tech giants and the like. And so that's the kind of thing that there are some concerns about. I would also add, by the way, that just in terms of scale, Google alone, for example, has a market capitalization greater than Comcast, Charter, and every other cable company in the United States combined. So it's not like we're talking about, the David of Silicon Valley versus the Goliath of broadband providers. This is a free market, of course, and they can negotiate with each other, but it's not as if Google's lacking for market power or Facebook or any of these other tech giants.
Well, one thing that's interesting, too, is I know that you've said that you will be stepping down from your position at the end of the Trump administration. What does the future look like on net neutrality? Do you think under a Biden administration, the FCC may reimpose the regulation?
It's certainly up to the future FCC. It could be that the FCC will tackle it, or it could be that Congress will pursue legislation to establish it, or both. We'll have to wait and see. But certainly, I think this is a matter of religious faith more than reason in certain quarters on the left. Every candidate out there has to virtue signal. And yes, I'm, of course, in favor of these utility style regulations, despite the fact that the absence of them hasn't been catastrophic as they predicted. But we'll see what happens. I think it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. And whatever decision they make, I think ultimately in the long run, everybody would be better off with Congress passing a simple piece of legislation, no blocking, no throttling, no anti-competitive pay prioritization, transparency. That's a very simple framework for open internet protections that I think all of us could agree on.
So one thing is, in the last 2 years, right, when the doomsday calls haven't come true, has the pressure from the left to reinstate net neutrality? I know the Democrats passed a bill called the Save the Internet Act that that never passed, but it would have reimposed it. But now that the doomsday calls have never happened, has the push died down? Has the momentum slowed, or is it still as strong as it was?
The sense I get is that it is definitely tamped down quite a bit. In fact, I did a podcast recently with the neoliberals, and a number of them were saying, chiming in on the chat, like, wow, we really thought this was a hot issue back in 2017. And whatever happened to that? Or, why do we hate this guy so much? And that's what it is. Kind of interesting to see now, whenever I get emails or tweets or whatever, a number of them have said exactly that we were sold a bill of goods, that we were promised the end of the internet, and all we got was faster speeds and better services. Like, what kind of apocalypse was this? But I think there is still a push among some quarters for political reasons. I mean, there are a lot of Beltway activists who make their living literally on pushing these apocalyptic predictions and pushing politicians to accede to them. And so I would anticipate that, that sound and fury is going to continue. So, it's, again, a waste of time, given that the fact that we have much higher priorities, like connecting everyone to the internet, making sure that everybody has the ability to benefit from these technologies. But politics is what it is.
So another thing that I know you focused on is 5G. Could you maybe explain for the lay audience, what is 5G?
Yeah, so if you have a phone today, chances are you're connecting over a 4G LTE connection. Well, 5G is the next generation of wireless connectivity, and it promises speeds that are up to 100 times faster. The responsiveness of the network will be much greater. So if you click on a link, it'll be much quicker for you to access that link. If you're playing a game, you'll see much more synchronous activity there, that sort of thing. But what's interesting about 5G is that it uses different bands of spectrum, different airwaves, and it also requires different infrastructure. The networks themselves will look different. Instead of big cell towers, you'll see smaller infrastructure the size of a pizza box dotting the landscape. And so, the other change is going to be that it will underlie virtually everything we do, not just making phone calls or surfing the web, but for businesses, for telehealth, tele-education, remote learning, precision agriculture, gaming. It's going to transform all these industries in really exciting ways. And that's why the FCC has put a premium on leading the charge for American leadership in this area.
And what exactly have you been trying to do? Help with the rollout, create a regulatory framework, or what has it been that you focused on with your work related to 5G?
So a couple of years ago, I introduced what would I call the 5G Fast Plan, a plan for facilitating America's superiority in 5G technologies. Now, you can get a lot more detail at fcc.gov/5G, but in a nutshell, there were three basic parts of the plan: getting more spectrum out there for the commercial marketplace, making it easier to deploy the wireless infrastructure of the future, and number three, modernizing our regulations to encourage more deployment of optical fiber. Even though these are wireless networks, with all these connected devices from cars to refrigerators, you need a lot of fiber to carry that wireless traffic back into the core of the networks. And we've been hard at work on each one of those and gotten incredible results in terms of spectrum and infrastructure. The metrics have been off the charts compared to what we thought it would be 2 years ago.
So shifting gears slightly, I want to ask about a different issue that's cropped up. Section 230 of the Communications Act. So you originally suggested that the FCC was interested in potentially revisiting this regulation. And now you said that because you're leaving office, you won't be doing it right now. But this isn't going anywhere, this issue, right? But my question is that generally, the policies you've pursued, you've called in pursuit of light touch regulation that lets the market work. But isn't tinkering with Section 230 opposed by most people who believe in free markets, light regulation? So I'm just asking, is this issue different in your view?
Well, so it depends on what type of tinkering you might have in mind. For example, President-elect Biden explicitly campaigned on repealing Section 230 altogether. There's a bipartisan consensus in Congress that some changes have to be made. But our proposed focus was much, much more narrow. If you look at the statement I put out in October, for example, what I said was there's an immunity provision within Section 230. Section 230 does a number of things, but there's an immunity provision there with respect to interactive service providers. And so what I said was, should we take a look at what the proper scope of the immunity provision is? This is a provision of law, after all, that's a part of the Communications Act. The FCC administers the Communications Act. Should we have a conversation about what the proper interpretation of that law is? Just a very narrow function. So that's exactly what we were looking to do, not some wholesale reform of 230's terms. We can't do that. That's up to Congress to decide. So I think some people might have read more or less, I guess, depending on your point of view, into what it was that we proposed to do.
So that's an interesting one, because I think there is this bipartisan call, but were you to take away that immunity entirely, which I understand isn't your position, but that is the position, like you said, of Joe Biden and President Trump himself in some tweets, wouldn't that make social media as we know it essentially impossible if they had to vet every tweet for potential liability?
And I think this is what you put your finger on in that question is exactly the reason why it's going to be important for Congress, if they go down this road, to really think carefully about what some of the consequences are, positive or negative. Because I think obviously when you're talking about changing legislation, the question is always going to be, if there are a lot of reliance interests based on this legislation as it stands, how would those reliance interests be affected? How would the internet experience be affected for people going forward? And so I'm sure through congressional hearings and debates and things like that, they'll be able to sort through those questions. But that's something for elected officials to think about, certainly.
So here's a question. What's next for you, Mr. Chairman, after the FCC?
So I have put it out there that I am willing to serve as a slot receiver for the Kansas City Chiefs as they make their next Super Bowl run as a big Chiefs fan. Barring something like that popping itself up, I'm going to have to think about what the next adventure is. One of the things I've been incredibly blessed about during my career, if you look at my career trajectory, it's been very nonlinear, but I always found a job that was really interesting to me, that gave me a sense of purpose and intellectual stimulation and the like. And I have faith that whatever the next adventure is, it'll continue in that trend. But it's certainly been the honor of a lifetime to serve in this position. And hopefully whatever comes next will be similarly rewarding.
So I was told to ask you about Ginger, and I don't know what that's all about, but can you explain to the audience?
Well, thank you. This is the best question I've ever had in an interview. So Ginger is our English bulldog. She just turned 5 months old. In fact, I don't know if you can hear her. She's snoring off to the side. Being a bulldog puppy, she snores a lot. But she's just been a wonderful addition to our home. She's already active on social media. She's tweeting at a lot of bulldog. And so she's just been a character. And there's something about the bulldog breed, and this one in particular, that really just puts a spring in your step. It's just a wonderful accent to what's otherwise been a somewhat dismal time.
Right, for sure. And so to end on a lighter note, every guest that comes on my show, I ask about their hot food take. I'm known for my food takes. I've had some guests on here say some truly weird stuff. To give a couple examples, Steve Forbes told me he likes peanut butter and bacon sandwiches. Rand Paul talks about how he despises mayonnaise and thinks there's a conspiracy to sneak it into your food. So, Mr. Chairman, what is your hot food take that you can lay on the audience of this podcast?
So I have often said to my family and friends that if the revolution comes, when the revolution comes, and I'm at the top of the barricades, among the first things to go will be bay leaves, celery, and mayonnaise. I think that and capers too, I should add as well. I mean, it just I whenever I try foods that have one or multiple of those different ingredients, I just sort of cringe. Either they're irrelevant, like bay leaves, and I think bay leaves are pretty much just virtue signaling for people who want to say, oh, wow, it really adds a little bit of flavor, or it's just affirmatively gross, like capers or mayonnaise. I just, but anyway, I know that people have very strong feelings, positive and negative, about each of these things, and I've gotten some blowback about bay leaves on Twitter, but yeah, I'm going to stick to my guns. You don't compromise your principles when you get criticized for them. You've got to stick with it and defend your case as best you can.
Whether it's net neutrality or food garnish, that's the philosophy.
That's absolutely right. You've got to stick to your guns.
All right, Mr. Chairman, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Brad. Great to be with you again.
All right, everybody, that's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in, and make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.